Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he was 19 years old and halfway around the world on Christmas Eve 1944, and the Germans were headed for him and two fellow soldiers.
So I climbed up that hill and fired the bazooka, and the motor stopped.
But that wasn't the end of it. No, just the beginning. Catch the rest of this prisoner of war's story today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9. Brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. I bet you're listening to us on 580 AM or maybe in the evening on FM 105.9, the FM KMJ. Maybe you're even listening long distance online, kmjnow.com. Anytime around the world, you can hear this program. And we're very blessed here in the San Joaquin Valley to have so many folks who have done a lot more than we realize for the sake of our freedom. The reason we call the show Hometown Heroes is the idea that no matter where your hometown is, no matter how big or how small it might be, there are heroes around you, people who have done incredible things for the sake of freedom. We want to honor our veterans. We want to thank them. And we don't want their stories to be forgotten. We're going to have not just Hometown Heroes today, but our own version of the Cosby Show. That's C-O-Z-B-Y with Leonard Cosby of Tulare, California. But originally not from California at all, Mr. Cosby. You grew up in Arkansas. What was that like in Arkansas before World War II?
Well, it was very pleasant, and we enjoyed living on the farm. My dad was a farmer. And we were well experienced in plowing fields and milking cows and pitching hay.
I bet you were. I bet you got lots of practice. You know, normally I start out by asking veterans about their memories of December 7th, 1941. But there was something that happened in your life earlier in 1941 that was obviously a very big deal. You lost your father that year in February. What happened?
Yes.
And how did you deal with that?
Well, he got sick. And he passed away, and we went back home to the farm and tried to take care of the place and keep things together.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there for about 6 months. And then my mother married the man that had been working for us. And shortly after that, we moved to Neosho, Missouri.
And is that where you were when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yes, it is. And that's where I was drafted from also.
Now, when you brought that up, you know, I wondered, a lot of guys during this time period got deferments for staying to work on the family farm. And here your father had passed away. And I wondered if that was a possibility for you. But you were drafted
right
shortly after Pearl Harbor?
In September of 43.
Well, tell me about December 7th. Do you remember finding out about this unbelievable thing that had happened out in the Hawaiian Islands? Do you remember how that struck you at the time?
Well, it was an amazing thing, and I couldn't understand why such a thing would be happening to us and the purpose of it.
Sounds like 1941 was a really difficult year for you. You lose your father, now your country's at war, and your head must have been spinning a little bit.
Well, it was, but we were thankful that we were able to live through it and keep our feet on the ground and keep going.
Mm-hmm. So you end up drafted in September of 43, and your younger brother goes in the service with you?
Right.
As your twin?
Yes.
Even though he's 18 months younger?
Correct.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, we just volunteered. We went in and we were drafted, and papers you had to fill out and sign up. So we both went in together and filled them out and signed them up, and they accepted them.
So you were 18. He was 16 and a half. He was not old enough to serve, but they didn't ask him for his birth certificate or anything?
No.
How about that? And were you concerned at all that he might be too young? I mean, you probably felt pretty young yourself.
No, I figured if this was what he wanted to do, and we had been together all the time anyway, everywhere we went, everything we did.
Mm-hmm. So I bet as you joined together, you were probably hoping to stick together.
Right.
What did Uncle Sam say?
Well, he sent me to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, combat engineers, and he sent my brother Lewis to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas in the armored infantry. And after about 6 or 8 weeks at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, I asked for transfer to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas. So I was transferred to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas.
And I bet it didn't take you long to find your brother.
No. I was assigned to the same barracks, and we both had the same sergeant in command of the barracks, and the first lieutenant, and the captain, and the same company.
And you had no idea what you were going to experience in this war. You certainly had no idea you were going to be a prisoner of war. But what did that mean to you, to be there with your brother? Do you think it made things easier to deal with for you?
I think it did, because it was all a new experience for both of us.
And being a toughened farm boy who had spent all that time pitching hay and everything you talked about, did that make basic training and getting whipped into shape a little easier for you? Did you feel like you had already done some of that, or did the Army toughen you up?
Well, the Army toughened us up a lot because we were taking training and hikes and doing things that we would have never done as farm boys.
Did it ever feel like too much for you?
No. At no time did it.
Did you find yourself itching to get overseas and do something that really mattered?
Not really. I was just feeling that if they wanted me to go, well, at the end of my basic training, I would be ready to go. I wouldn't have any objections to going, because I knew there was plenty of guys already out there ahead of me.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up putting you in the 80th Infantry Division?
Well, what happened was, after our basic training at Camp Chaffee, we went to Fort Meade, Maryland to go overseas, and since we had signed up together as twins, they would not ship me out overseas without his name on the order, and they had orders for me to go over. His name wasn't on it. They had orders for him to go over, and my name wasn't on it. So eventually what they did, they sent us to Camp Reynolds, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
for some special training to send us to the Pacific. And while we were there, they gave us any serviceman that had not had a leave of absence in 6 months would get a 10-day leave of absence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we were drafted from Neosho, Missouri, my parents signed up to work in California because workers were needed in the defense work in California.
Mm-hmm.
So from Camp Reynolds, Pennsylvania, with a 10-day leave, we hitchhiked to Torrance, California. And then we spent probably 2 or 3 days there. And our parents gave us bus tickets to go back to Camp Reynolds, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
When we arrived back there, our unit had already been shipped out.
Mm.
And the lieutenant there was not too happy that we had been absent without leave. But he said, since you did not leave on me, he says, I'm not going to do anything about it.
Mm.
So from there, they sent us to Camp Van Dorn, Mississippi, for foot infantry training. And we finished our foot infantry training there and went back to Fort Meade, Maryland. And we were shipped out overseas. We went over on the Queen Mary,
mm-hmm.
took us 5 days to get there. We crossed England on a train and then crossed the canal into France. And from there, they put us on a truck and hauled us, I'd say within a 15-hour hike of our assignment.
Mm-hmm.
three of us, in addition to our sergeant that was assigned as a roadblock. And on our way to the roadblock, our assignment there, we had to cross a meadow. And there was a stream running through this meadow, and there was a fence going across it also. So we climbed through the fence, and one of the guys, in the process of climbing through the fence, fired his rifle, and somebody hollered, "Mines." So I think that, to me, that was the worst scared that I was through the whole operation. Nothing, my experience in the service, scared me more than that, because I thought, the next step I take, I'll probably step on a mine. Also, at the far side of this meadow, there was a person there in a Nazi uniform running across the meadow. Everybody was getting down in position to start shooting at the guy. And I got down in position to shoot, and I was ready to pull the trigger. And one of our guys ran over and squatted down right in front of me. And if I had fired my rifle, I would have probably killed him. So this guy running across the meadow, he got away. And, of course, we figured, well, if I had been able to fire, I could have hit him.
Right.
But who knows? And from there, we went on to our roadblock position.
This was late 1944?
Late in 44. It would have been right at Christmas time.
Which, of course, everyone knows Christmas 1944 was the Battle of the Bulge. Let me go back to something. You talked about you and your brother heading out together because you were twins.
Right.
Did the military have a different policy at that time for twins versus just ordinary siblings?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Because I went over and was assigned to this group for our roadblock, and he was assigned with some other unit, and he was caught in an artillery barrage. And he ended up in England in the hospital.
Well, that had to be hard for you.
Well, I didn't know this at the time. I didn't know where he went or what had happened until I was back in the United States. And I ended up at Fort Bliss at El Paso, Texas.
Yep.
And I had a half-brother in El Paso. I visited with him. I called my mother. And she told me that he had been wounded and that he was in the hospital in England.
Gotcha. And I'll come back around to that. So it says here that was December 22nd of 44 that you had this patrol where you're going through the fence and a rifle goes off and someone yells mines and you're scared out of your mind. And I understand that at the end of that night, now you had been trained as an infantryman.
Right.
You had a rifle on your shoulder.
Correct.
But you were not a bazooka man. You'd never fired a bazooka before.
No.
And that was going to change pretty soon.
That it did.
How did that happen?
Well, our sergeant said that we needed a bazooka man, and this kid there, he looked to me like he was probably about 16, 17 years old. He really looked young to be 18-year-old. And he said, told the sergeant, "I'll be the bazooka man." And then the sergeant said, "Well, you need an assistant." So he came over to me and put his arm around my shoulder and says, "I want him for my assistant." So I said, "Okay." So between him and myself, in addition to our own equipment, we carried the bazooka and a couple of shells back to our assignment.
But before long, he decided that he couldn't handle shooting that bazooka, right?
Well, it was after we arrived to our position as a roadblock. We were in this position there for the roadblock. Motors started coming up the road. And I told him that, well, there's a vehicle coming up the road. We should shoot the bazooka and stop the vehicle from coming up the road. I said, somebody has to shoot the bazooka. And this kid says, "I can't do it. I can't. I just can't shoot the bazooka. I can't do it." So the position we were in, on one side of us was a wooden garage, and on the other side of us, behind us was hills, and on the other side of us was another small hill. So I climbed up that hill and fired the bazooka, and the motor stopped. We didn't hear the motor anymore. So it was nighttime, so I really don't know what I hit. But fortunately, the motor stopped and we didn't hear anything else.
So was that beginner's luck or what? I mean, the first shot you ever fired with the thing and you hit your target.
Well, I just fired in the direction of the motor.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, it worked out all right.
And I guess you realized later that by hitting that vehicle that you did, it kind of blocked or delayed any German advance or progress from that point?
Yes, it did.
So what happened from there? Because there were still Germans inside of it that could get out of it and shoot at you.
Well, in our position there is a roadblock. Before the sergeant left us, a motorcycle came by with a couple of guys on it, and he shot at the motorcycle and knocked the guy off of the motorcycle, and he took the guy down to our headquarters for questioning, and this left three of us in the position of roadblock. None of us had been in any war or any shooting or any kind of battles. And it was after this that I fired the bazooka and that stopped that motor from coming up the road. And shortly after this, a Jeep came driving by and drove down the road a ways, and we could hear someone groaning down the road. And evidently it was a German soldier laying over by the side of the road that had been wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And this Jeep drove down to where this person was lying, and the person in the Jeep got out and walked around behind the Jeep, and he lit a pipe or cigarette, whatever he was smoking, and then he walked over to the ditch by the side of the road, pulled his gun, and shot the person that was lying in the ditch.
Mm.
Because the person was lying there moaning and hollering and all. And the guy went back, got in his Jeep, and drove off.
Was that hard to witness? Did that leave an impression on you?
Well, it did that. This is the facts of war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I figured, well, maybe it's better that the guy's out of his misery.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was no way that an ambulance or medication could get to him. So at least the guy isn't hurting or suffering anymore.
But if it had been you lying in the ditch, I'm sure there's part of you that says, if that was me moaning and groaning, I don't know what I would prefer in that situation.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would, if I was able to ask, I don't know what I would ask for.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what, we need to stop right there and take our first commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to get the rest of this story right around Christmas time, 1944, while people were back around their fireplaces back home singing carols. Mr. Cosby was doing nothing like that. He was in a war zone, and we're going to hear how the war ended up for him, the rest of his story, when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. That bed, I heard my wife say, in a way that I knew she was either really, really happy or really upset. Paul Leffler here for Sleep Retreat, and if it had been the latter, I wouldn't be telling you about it. No, she was excited. That bed, she said, is so comfortable. She had just gotten her first taste of our new Tempur-Pedic mattress from Sleep Retreat, Fresno's only premium bedding store. And I'm not making this up. She didn't want to move. That's how much she loves the comfort and support that Tempur-Pedic's technology delivers. This is not one mattress fits all. The trained professionals at Sleep Retreat can walk you through the whole spectrum from soft to firm. But the one thing all the Tempur-Pedics have in common is they adapt to your exact shape to support every part of your body. If you've slept on a conventional mattress your whole life, like I have, this is something you've never experienced before. Do yourself and your sleeping habits a favor by trying out the most recommended bed in America. Visit your Tempur-Pedic Comfort Center in Central California. That's Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 87-year-old Leonard Cosby of Tulare. Maybe you worked with him in the newspaper business down in Tulare or out on the coast in Watsonville once upon a time. Did you know he was a prisoner of war? Well, we haven't gotten to that part yet, but we're going to shortly. He was telling us about Christmas time, 1944. Of course, that frigid winter in Europe, the Battle of the Bulge raging on. And he was in Luxembourg at the time setting up a roadblock. He told us about taking over bazooka duties and the first shot he ever fired with that weapon, taking out a German vehicle. But the dark of night can be a scary thing. And oh, by the way, this was Christmas Eve. Not exactly what you imagined for your Christmas Eve, I suppose. What was it like to be out there in darkness, knowing that there are enemy troops out there and not knowing what was going to happen? Pick that story up where you left off and help us understand what it felt like for this young man. You're what, 19 years old out there?
Yes.
And you'd had your brother join with you. He's in your same division, your same outfit, but he's not with you now.
No, he was in some other area where he had been wounded by an artillery barrage.
Which you weren't aware of yet?
No, I was not aware of that until I returned to the United States.
But you had plenty to worry about yourself here.
Yes, I did.
What happened from there? What kinds of things were you seeing, hearing? What was that night like?
Well, after the person driving the Jeep had driven off and was gone, some German soldiers sneaked up and started shooting at us. They couldn't get a direct shot into where we were, so they were shooting at an angle. And on our right side was a wooden, kind of like a garage, where they had parked something inside the garage. This German was shooting at us. They had some tracer bullets in with their ammunition, and the tracer bullet would hit the side of this wooden garage and stick there and fry. They didn't last long, just a few seconds, and they went out. That was the only time they came up there attempting to shoot us or shoot at us. And to this day, I can't understand why they didn't throw a hand grenade or something in there at us.
You're not complaining that they didn't?
Oh, no. No, fortunately. Fortunately, I made it through it in fine shape.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's additional vehicles coming up the road, so we had two bazooka shells. We had already used one, so now it's time to use the other one. And I moved up on the ridge and loaded the bazooka gun and fired it. And when a bazooka shell hits metal, out the other side of the metal will be flying molting metal. And when I fired the bazooka gun, I could hear some German soldiers down there screaming and hollering. And after that, we didn't hear much of anything from them. There was no firing at us or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that must have been about, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
And how many people are with you here?
There's 3 of us in that roadblock.
3 of us. So this is not a well-fortified position. You don't have a lot of reinforcements. You guys are out there on your own.
Right. And there's really not much of anything around us to protect us either.
And you have no idea how many Germans are out there?
No.
So it's 3 in the morning.
And one of the fellows became excited, and I guess he was a little bit hysterical. He said, we're going to have to do something. It's going to be daylight here before you know it. And when it gets light, the Germans are going to come in here and kill us all. He said, we're going to have to give up. And I said, that might be all right. But I said, who's going to walk out in the middle of the road to give up?
Mm-hmm.
And I was standing down near the front of our position there, and this guy just pushed me right out in the middle of the road. So I started yelling, comrade, comrade.
And this is about daybreak or what?
Well, I'd say it's about 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning.
So you didn't want to wait till the sun came up?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was afraid that they would come in there and tear us to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, I don't know why the Germans didn't start shooting, but they took all three of us as prisoners and took us down to a German officer who questioned us as to what organization we were in, what unit we were in, and how long we had been there.
Not very long.
No.
Didn't have much to tell them, did you? Not that you would have anyway.
No. Well, I'm sure they knew the organization we were in, what division and all.
Emotionally, what was that like? Because here you have put in all this time and training, not to mention your brother going in with you, and you're going over there to win a war. And now all of a sudden, you've had this intense experience where you didn't know if you were going to die, and here you are surrendering, not knowing what the future holds. That seems like an awful lot to try to process in a 19-year-old brain.
Well, I didn't know what to expect from the Germans or where they would take us, but they had us marching for a ways, and then they put us on trucks and hauled us back into Germany. And they took us to a large building, like a gym, and took us inside the building. Inside the building, we had POWs who were in charge of the event. Some of these people that were POWs had been POWs for as long as 5 years.
Mm.
They got all of us inside this gymnasium and said that any person, everyone, will have to shower. And here it is wintertime with ice and snow outside and cold water.
Mm-hmm.
No warm water.
And the coldest winter on record.
Just about, yes.
Yeah.
And so they said, now, if you don't want a shower, we will have to give you a shower with a GI brush. So I thought, they're crazy. I'm not going to get in there in that shower in the cold water. Well, fortunately, about three guys ahead of me said, I'm not taking a shower. And they said, well, you have to take a shower. He says, I'm not taking a shower. Well, we'll have to give you a shower with a GI brush. And these old brushes have long black bristles on it. So when I saw how they gave him a shower with a GI brush, that changed my mind. So I went ahead and I walked up there to take a shower, and I asked this guy, I said, how do you do this? And he said, well, you just move into it a little bit at a time. And he said, that's the best way to shower in the cold water. After the shower is over, you feel a lot better, and it's really encouraging.
Whereas if you chose the GI brush option, you're going to be in pain for quite a while.
Yes, you would be. You'd have a lot of red streaks all over you.
Mm-hmm. So that was your welcome to life as a prisoner of war moment.
Yes, it was. And from there, we were assigned to Stellag 4B. We were billeted in a building in the small town.
That's in the town of, what is it, Wolfsburg, Germany?
Yes, it was back in Germany.
Stellag 4B. And it's still wintertime. It's freezing cold. They welcome you to Stellag 4B, and I'm sure they just set out a great big piping hot feast for you and gave you a king's welcome.
Yes, they did. We had black bread and turnip soup.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
And then our job was to sweep the streets, clean the place up, and to go out and in the woods and gather wood for fire in our room that we had.
Mm-hmm.
They sent three of us out to gather wood, and we were guarded by Hitler Youth kids. And the kids there was three of them, and they had rifles. And we were out gathering the wood, and I had an attack of dysentery, and I stopped. And this German youth felt I was taking too long. I should have speeded up more. And he came over and says, Rockstell Schmeinhuhn, and struck me in the back with his rifle. It wasn't something that knocked me down or anything. It caused my back to be sore for a while, but it really wasn't too serious.
And that, to translate that German, I caught the last part, Schmeinhund, is pig dog, which is like the biggest insult they could hurl at you, especially coming from the Hitlerjugend.
Mucksnail, I don't know what that means.
I'll have to look for the translation, but you had a pretty clear idea that he wanted you to...
He meant business.
Yeah, and that hurt you.
Yes, so we went back to our quarters.
All right, so mocked schnell means hurry up or make it quick. So it was, make it quick, pig dog. Anyway, what happened next?
I'm not sure how long after that. I broke out in some red bumps. I don't know what I had, and the Germans there, they didn't know what I had or what was wrong. So they sent me to a POW hospital, and that's where I was when I got liberated.
So that actually, if you look at the big picture, that might have been a fortunate break for you to get those red bumps.
I figure it was, yes.
Because life in the POW camp was not very pleasant for you.
Well, it wasn't very pleasant, but really it wasn't something that you were in fear of all the time either. And at the time that I was a POW there, the Allies had blown up so many of the railroad tracks that it was very difficult getting Red Cross partials into Germany. Prior to this, POWs over there would get a Red Cross partial once a week. But when I was in there, they had a Red Cross partial, one partial for two guys. Then when I was liberated, the company that I was with when I got captured was the same company that liberated me.
How about that?
And this one, they had a army vehicle there that was a weapons carrier. And I was standing over there by that vehicle, and I noticed there was a, what they called a D bar, which was a special bar with vitamins and minerals and everything in it to keep you healthy. I noticed one of those in the back of this weapons carrier, and I asked the sergeant if I could have that D bar. He said yes. And I found that there was a bunch of them back there. So I ate several D-bars. I ate so many that I later went and sat on the back steps of the room that we were staying in and stayed up most of the night with a stomachache.
I bet. And a lot of POWs have related similar experiences from starving for so long, then finally being liberated and eating to their heart's content only to have to eat again shortly after because they couldn't keep it down. And I want to touch on this because, you know, you're captured in December of 44. You're not liberated till April of 45. You went over there. You're a strapping farm boy, about 150 pounds or so?
Yes.
How much did you weigh when you were liberated?
I weighed 98 pounds when I got liberated.
So you lost a third of your body weight.
Yes, I did.
And when you mentioned the black bread and the turnip soup, and I sarcastically joked about, you know, how well they fed you, they really didn't feed you well at all. And I'm sure it was hard to stay warm sometimes, too. I mean, this was not a very pleasant existence, was it?
No, it was not. And it was much better after I went to that POW hospital.
Sure, sure.
And the place was fenced in, a double fence around it. And one of the patients there came to me and said, well, let's me and you escape from here. And I said, well, you think we can? Oh, yeah. And he said, we can go out there and crawl under the fence and we can get away. So I said, well, I'll go out and take a look at it. So I went out there and took a look at the double fence around the place. And I noticed there was a German shepherd dog between the fences. So I went back and told the guy that if he wanted to go, he was welcome to do so. But I was not taking a chance on it.
And I think history has proven that you made a wise choice in that regard. Well, we need to catch another break, but when we come back, we'll talk to Mr. Cosby about his liberation and touch on a few more of his prisoner of war experiences as well. Leonard Cosby of Tulare, California, our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose. For years, Paso Robles has been known for the Mid-State Fair and its world-class wineries. Coming Saturday, September 29th, a new event will join those two. Estrella Warbird Museum, in conjunction with the Plains of Fame Air Museum, presents Warbirds Over Paso. Thrill to the roar of P-51 Mustangs, a P-38 Lightning, F-4U Corsair, and even a North American B-25 Bomber. Tour the C-47, a true veteran of World War II, and see many more in breathtaking flybys. See the world's only N-9M Flying Wing, forerunner of the B-2 Stealth Bomber. Warbird rides available before and after the flying display. Gates open 8 a.m. Admission $20. Active duty military and kids under 12 free. Admission includes open house at the museum, free parking, food and beverage vendors on site. Sponsored in part by Firestone Walker Brewing Company, it's Warbirds Over Paso, Saturday, September 29th at the Paso Robles Municipal Airport on Airport Road off Highway 46. Call 805-277-0440 or go to ewarbirds.org/airshow.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to come down the home stretch now with Leonard Cosby. He's 87 years old. Doesn't sound like it, does he? He has a sharp memory of his days in World War II. He was in the 80th Infantry Division, got to Europe in late 1944, was captured Christmas Eve, actually, I guess the morning, Christmas Day of 1944, and was liberated April of 45. Along the way, he lost a third of his body weight from 150 pounds to 98 with that wonderful POW diet of sawdust bread and turnip soup in Stalag 4B in Germany. I want to read for you something. You know, a lot of POWs save mementos from their time in camps. Mr. Cosby has a couple very unique souvenirs. One of them is a beautiful Christmas card. It says, Merry Christmas, 1944. And it was sent to his mother back in California. It says, Tuesday, December 5th, 1944, Northern France. Dearest Mother and John, hope this finds you all having a nice Christmas and not worrying about Lewis and myself. It's like the chaplain said the other day when he was talking to us, it is never so bad, but what, it can't be worse. If it is God's will that we come back, then we will be back. All that we can do is hope and pray to God to see us through the worst. I will close wishing you all a Merry, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. With love, forever, Leonard. Boy, that's quite the statement that you made in there, huh? That it's never so bad, but what, it can't be worse. And if it is God's will that we come back, then we will be back.
And that is something that I think that you really depend on.
And you wrote this December 5th.
Right.
20 days later, you became a guest of the Gestapo, as they say. As you spent those 4-plus months in captivity, is that something, that concept, that God would see you through this, something that you were able to hold on to help you get through that time?
I believe it was, yes.
How did that play out in the day-to-day? Because here you are, a 19-year-old kid, freezing your rear end off with nothing to eat. You're a captive at the hands of the Germans. How did you get through day to day? What were some of the things that you guys did in camp to keep your spirits up?
Well, we were busy out working on the streets, sweeping them and cleaning them up, and that took a lot of our time. Also, we would be visited by Germans who would drop in to see if we were all right and see if everything was okay. But other than that, that was about the extent of it.
And I imagine among the prisoners, just like the night you were captured, it was one of the three of you who was so concerned that he ended up spurring the decision to surrender to the Germans in that instance. I imagine that in captivity, you had a spectrum of guys that were very optimistic and confident and guys that were very discouraged and feared that they wouldn't make it. Is that fair to say that you had a big variety there?
Well, no, I never noticed the other guys, how they felt, or as so much because I was trying to take care of myself and keep a positive attitude so that I wouldn't demoralize myself and look at it on the worst side.
And how often did you think about your little brother who's out there somewhere?
Well, probably about every day. Probably every day, wondering, well, I haven't heard from him, so I hope he's all right.
Well, and you speak of hearing from people, and when you're in a prisoner of war camp, it's kind of hard to stay in close contact to people. Did you get any mail from home or from anywhere other than
that?
Nothing.
I was, for the length of time I was in there, I didn't receive any letters or mail of any kind from anyone.
But you were able to get a note out to your mom.
Right.
And I'm holding that right here. And it is on a form that, of course, is in German. Let's see if I can say this right. Kriegsgefangenenlager. And that is basically saying that it's coming from a prisoner of war camp, I believe. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it says, January 24th, 1945. Dearest mother, I am living very well and hope you are getting my mail. Is the rest of the family okay? I hope so. Don't forget to send me a box as soon as possible and pray to God that we all get back home safe. I'm not making out the last part.
At this late date, I doubt if I could even make it out.
Well, and this is an old piece of paper, and it's on black paper and white ink, so that's hard too. But it does say, well, obviously that's a big thought there.
Special from Deutschland.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then it ends with love and kisses. And then, of course, you sign your initials there. But please send me a box as soon as you can and pray to God that we all get home safe. Now, you said in that opening line, and this is after you've been a prisoner for about a month, I am living very well. Did you really feel that way, or were you saying that to make your mom feel better?
Well, I wanted to make her feel better. But I felt that under the circumstances and being healthy, I was living very well, considering all the circumstances and the shortage of food and everything.
Anything else from your time at Stalag 4B that stands out in your memory?
Well, the thing that I guess wherever you go, there's politics involved. I know while I was in the POW hospital, they had a commissary there. The commissary was ruled by an American sergeant and a British sergeant. So anytime there was something missing from the commissary, one sergeant didn't know whether the other sergeant took it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to keep an eye on each other. And I know there was items missing from the commissary that did not go to the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were some Germans living across the street from the hospital that had items that came from the commissary.
And you were there for about 2 months, I guess, right, at this hospital?
Uh-huh.
In Leipzig. And the doctors, the nurses, all the staff, these are Germans.
Yes, they were.
How did they treat you?
The German commander of the hospital came out. And as I look back on it, I didn't realize it at the time, but as I look back on it, he was looking for me, but he couldn't pronounce my name. So I didn't know if he was wanting me or who he was hollering for.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really, at one point, he was really screaming and yelling and hollering. He was about to go off of his rocker because the person he was looking for, he couldn't find.
And why was he looking for you?
Well, I would say he was looking for me to discharge me from the hospital and send me back to a POW camp.
Good thing he couldn't find you then.
Yes. Yes. I feel that I was better off in the hospital there than I would have been back in the POW camp. And after we were liberated, I felt that I was really under the weather. I was weak and not very muscular. But I was out in the yard from where we were billeted, and somebody started shooting a gun. And when that first person started shooting, there was a bunch of firearms going off, and it didn't take me long to duck inside of the building there.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot more energy than what I realized I did have.
When you needed it, it was there, huh?
Yes.
Well, tell me about that liberation. April 4th, 1945, a date, I guess, that you'll never forget. How did that unfold? Did you know this was about to happen?
I didn't know when it was going to happen or how, but I know the unit that I'd been assigned to came through and liberated us, and they took us to one side, and they furnished us with a canteen cup of something like a milkshake to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took us from there to the airport where American planes were, and they put me on a plane and flew me to, I think it was Le Havre, mm-hmm. France.
Camp Lucky Strike?
And then while there, they gave us this high vitamin and high mineral food and drink, and then they assigned us to a boat to come home on.
Couple questions there. You talked about your faith in God, and you wrote in that letter to your mother that she needed to pray that God would bring you home safe, and that if it was God's will, that you would make it home safe. So I bet that April 4th, when these guys from the 80th Infantry Division came through and liberated you, that probably felt like a big answer to prayer.
Yes, it did. And I felt that after that, I could make it back home. I would be on my way back home soon.
And, you know, I realize that an Army division, certainly, and even a smaller regiment and a company, those are still big groups of people. But did you see anybody that you knew when they came through and liberated you? Were there any familiar faces there?
No, but a couple of fellows told me that they said that you shouldn't have given up because we came up the hill and we would have liberated you. They wouldn't have had a chance to get in there and do anything to you.
Hmm.
That we came up the hill and we took care of them and you would have been all right. But this one guy really became hysterical. That's why I became a POW.
And of course, so when they say that to you, you say, now you tell me. Would have been nice to know that in the moment. But there's no guarantee that you would have survived.
No.
You would have seen a lot more combat. You might have experienced the tail end of the Battle of the Bulge.
I would have probably been with the troop that liberated me.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would have been with them liberating some other people out of that hospital.
Sure. And then that journey home. So I know you got a little seasick on the way over, getting there in a hurry on the Queen Mary. Coming back a couple weeks across the Atlantic on a Liberty ship. How'd
yes.
you handle that?
Oh, I spent most of my time down in the hole of the ship being seasick. That's why I would make a very poor sailor.
You're glad you didn't join the Navy. And after experiencing life as a prisoner, seeing your freedom taken from you, to get back to a free America again and step foot on the good old USA, what did that feel like?
That was great because I felt that I could get out and walk around and go where I wanted to go and do whatever I wanted to do without any hindrance and without any danger.
Which a lot of us take for granted.
Yes. Well, and it made me feel more like I was at home, even though I wasn't at my mother's place or in my home.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got the rest of your family story, your brother Lewis. When did you find out where he was and what had happened to him?
Well, when I came back from overseas, I was sent to Fort Bliss, Texas. I had a half-brother living in El Paso. So I went to see him, and I called my mother in California. And that was when she informed me that my brother had been wounded from an artillery barrage and he was in England in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and was getting along fine, doing okay.
When did you finally get to see him again?
It probably wasn't for maybe another 5 or 6 months after that, because I think he was sent home to the San Fernando Valley to a hospital there. And that was the first chance I had to go see him after he came back from overseas.
And what was that like to see each other? You had joined together. Here you end up a POW. He ends up with a Purple Heart, but you both made it home. What did you two talk about? How was that reunion?
Well, we didn't have much to say about our services. We were happy to see each other and delighted that we could get together and go home and visit with our mother. It was great knowing that he was recovering all right. But he suffered from it because he had pinpoint shrapnel in his body that was impossible to remove it.
Mm.
So that caused him some problems.
You said get home to see your mother. And I think back to your Christmas card to her and your letter from captivity where you requested that she pray for you guys. Something tells me the way it all worked out, she must have been praying an awful lot.
Well, I imagine she did, because there was three of us boys in the family, and my oldest brother was in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And we all came back home. When I came back home, I ended up living in California. In fact, we all three boys ended up living in California.
Mm-hmm. When you look at it now, and how many kids and grandkids do you have?
I have two boys, two sons, six grandkids, and three great-granddaughters, and two more great-grandkids on the way.
Wow. That's a lot of people that would have never been born if you didn't make it home from the war and meet your wife.
Yes, there were. That's true. Yep.
What does that do to you when you contemplate that, when you think of how easily you could have been killed that night in Luxembourg, the fact that you survived your time as a prisoner of war, even though you lost all that weight? How do you make sense of all that and figure out why you were able to survive and have the family and the life that you've enjoyed?
Well, to me, it's a question. I'm grateful for being here. And the question is, what happened that I am still here and that I've been kept here for all these years?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel blessed with everything that I have.
Well, amen. Do you think that people today understand what World War II was all about and what so many Americans went through?
I don't think they do. And I think one of the main reasons is that it is not being taught in schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think the schools are failing as far as teaching the young people everything that the United States went through for World War II. And there probably aren't even being schooled with Korea and Vietnam,
mm-hmm,
like they should be.
Well, and that's the idea behind this program, keeping these stories alive and letting people know from a firsthand perspective what this war was all about. So here's your chance. You know, you probably have grandchildren listening, your son sitting right here next to you. What do you want the future generations of your family and the rest of us to know about what you and all those Americans like you did all those years ago?
Well, I think we should do everything we can to avoid conflicts like that. But as I look at the situation, I can see that it's unavoidable. It appears to be unavoidable.
Do you think that your experience as a POW taught you things that you might not have learned otherwise? Did it change your perspective?
Yes, I think it did. And the fact that what it does take for you to survive on,
mm-hmm,
and anything and everything above that is a luxury.
Sounds like you haven't taken a lot for granted these last almost 70 years.
No, I'm just grateful and thankful for whatever I have and everything that I have and for the good family that I have and the offspring.
Well, we're grateful that you're willing to share your story with us, and I want to thank you for serving our country and for sharing that story with us today. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know?
I was drafted from Neosho, Missouri, and I was discharged from the service at Fort Ord, California.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being discharged from Fort Ord was the fact that my family was living in Torrance, California.
So that's how you ended up in California the rest of your life?
Yes, that's it.
Well, we're thankful for that. You ever get a strange longing for that horribly hard German POW bread?
Not lately, no. I would like to go back to Luxembourg and see the place where I was captured, but even if I went back, I don't know whether I would recognize it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the road might still be there and the wooden garage, and I don't know. But if I were financially able, I would probably take a chance on it.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be very interesting to find out, because there's certainly a lot of history in your life that unfolded there. That is Leonard Cosby of Tulare, California, a prisoner of war. And boy, the rest of us really don't know how much we take for granted, do we? If you want to see what Mr. Cosby looks like, if you want to see for yourself that Christmas card to his mother or the letter from captivity that I read on the program, go to kmjnow.com or check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. And join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.